So we continue our discussion on the mental structure, all those thoughts which were not expressed yet, or you have some comments or remarks or observations can be now shared.
I have a question that I can't completely reconcile, and I'd like to read out two little pieces of the book and get some feedback on that, but I found them quite interesting. There are surely enough historical instances of the catastrophic downfall of entire people and cultures. Such declines were triggered by the collision of deficient and exhausted attitudes that were insufficient for continuance with those more recent, more intense, and in some respects superior. One such occurrence vividly exemplifies the decisive nature of such crisis, the collision of the magical, mythical, and unperspectival culture of the Central American Aztecs with a rational, technological, perspectival attitude of the 16th century Spanish conquistadors. And he describes how the Spanish, because of their rationality and their technological advancement, mainly their rationality, were able to basically do away with the mythical world of the Aztecs. And within their world and value system, they didn't know how to deal with that imposition and intrusion, despite the fact that they were massively outnumbering the Spanish. Yet the Spanish had no problem with actually overpowering them. And he sees it as this crisis between two structures, you could say. But then on page, that's page 5. But then on page 72, he says something very interesting. He says 2,000 years later, and he refers to the emergence of the, you could say, the mental structure in the East, you know, in Greece and the Far East. But then 2,000 years later, he says, this question of awakening reappears at the outset of the 17th century in Spain. The unperspectival country lacking a renaissance and existing on the outer fringe of Europe. So in one instance, in the 16th century, he refers to the conquistadors as a perspectival structure that imposes itself on a former structure. But in page 72, he claims that in the one century later, Spain is actually an unperspectival country, right? Lacking renaissance and existing on the outer fringe of Europe. Now, from my rational mind, I see a contradiction. From another level, I might see a complementarity. But I think it's worth a discussion to find out how those two positions can be reconciled, and what, therefore, the question of context means in terms of reconciling those two positions.
Is it clear? The second one?
Here at the bottom. No, go ahead, I just want to have a look at it. Well, that's all I wanted to say, but I just wanted to point out there was something very interesting for me between those two statements, because they really seem to contradict one another. And yet, I think there's actually something that brings it together. Has anybody else hear the contradiction in what I try to point out? Yeah, okay.
First of all, what comes to my mind, why I smiled, that having conquered other civilizations, they brought subtle influence from it by being kind of interacting with them, bringing their rationality, their kind of ego structures, and conquering with that. He speaks not because of technological advantage, but because of their
superior structure.
Yes, because their superior ego structure, which is stronger than any mythical or magic structure, even if you are very efficient within that structure. In the magic world or the mythical world, those wizards and those sorcerers, they were stronger. They could really make anything that they wanted. They were sent to kill them. Those magicians were working on it. And they couldn't. And he refers to that song where they sing, they couldn't do it. There was no, they were not responding to them. They were already in cocoon of their own ego structure, which can stand, withstand the whole world.
The magic, yeah.
Yeah, the whole world, magic, mythical, any other world. And it reminds me of the Dhammapada statement by Buddha, where he says, you have to create for yourself an island where no gods, no demons, no the whole world can reach you. An island of your own being. And that's exactly where they were representing it. Why they were later kind of the outskirts of Europe and were representing something against that emergence of that mental structure, it's a question.
Is there a reversal? Is there a possibility for actually falling back that we have to accommodate for also? That it's not just something that emerges and then there's the next emergence of the next structure, but is there also the possibility that the emergent structure is not strong enough and it collapses on itself and reverts back?
But also when we're talking about a society like Spanish culture, it's going to have all the different structures in it at all times. Just like when we're talking about the mental structure, while you've been talking, Vladimir, it's so clear we're talking about scientific materialism. That's like the ultimate, as far as we know, expression of this mental structure. But art and culture, there are artists deconstructing things, there's Picasso there. I mean, there are a lot of things going on besides pure mentality. So I guess in Spain also, there would be, like, relative to the Aztecs, they were very perspectival. Relative to France, say, or Italy, they weren't.
So context becomes important.
Yeah.
In relationship to what? My perspective of, and in relationship to what I actually the opposite of.
And Vladimir, the concept of ratio, were there not invasions at that time? Did ratio have an influence in this shift?
Suddenly I got another possibility when you were talking that actually maybe even with Spain, whether that underdeveloped, so to say, it was just revealing the deficient structure of the mental calcium, which had to emerge later. Maybe they exercised it already too powerfully with conquering the whole America, that they exhausted the possibilities and they came to the deficient form its own, so to say, re-establishing dogma and inquisition and all that what we know.
But he called it specifically unperspectival.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would interpret the difference in terms of developmental social psychology. At that period, the period of the conquests and the discoverers, European rational thought was not generally shared. There were some who had the motive to sail and to conquer and to garner wealth, but that consciousness had not percolated down to the society as a whole. So when he says on the periphery of European thought, rationality, you know, it can also imply that general Spanish culture hadn't yet caught up to that line which shot across the world to conquer others, and we could find a parallel here with that. You know, when the British brought Western rational civilization to India, the response of India was pathetic. It just crumbled under that influence. Today, that rational civilization coming to India is just getting absorbed
by the masses.
By the mass, yeah. So there has been time enough, even though it doesn't appear to have been a lot of time, 100 years, because of the rate at which things are changing globally. Somehow the response now is much different because this society has taken some steps that at that time it wasn't ready to take. Now, that can obviously be very destructive also, because we can see here that the magical is still very strong. And my favorite example of the incursion of the rational is the automobile, where technology provides every individual the power to move anytime they like, anywhere they want, and it becomes totally individualized, but nothing is regulated. And so you find everyone trying to adjust at every moment to the total movement without any concept of how it could be regulated so that it's safe and efficient and so on.
You mean literally on the roads?
Literally on the road. So here we can see on the roads the collision of the rational and the magical every moment.
This is very interesting because I just read this week by chance an article, it's on the internet, that is a response to Orwell's town planning, saying this rational kind of planning and structuring and all of that, and you know, it's very sort of commonsensically done everywhere in the world now. But there's other ways of regulating or dysregulating traffic, and they showed actually places in Holland where they had invented a level of dysregulation where you wouldn't have traffic lights anymore and specific arrows and whatever. And what you literally saw, traffic doing the same as in India, but from a different place. Mm. I mean, this is fantastic. It's not what you see in Pondi, but it's based on the same principles of not trying to structure it or regulate it, but allowing people's consciousness to sort of like be attentive and socialized enough that they know what to do. So they do the same thing, but with a different attitude. And we could confuse the two, right? Amazing. But what you're also speaking to is what I suspect is the difference between the minority or an elite that spearheads something and moves into the next sort of like structure, and then the response of the masses or the general public that takes much longer. And maybe there is also an answer that you say.
I noticed in the last part of your comment, when we were discussing the vital and the psychic in Gebser, the example that you gave was that Gebser is mentioning that there are three. We have three parts to be aware of and bring together. We have the heart, we have the mind, the mental, and we have the body. And there, in the body realm, the vital and the physical are quite indistinguishable in his outlook. And this is one of the primary differences between his system of understanding and Sri Aurobindo's. And it's also reflected in Wilbur's system. Wilbur almost never recognizes the existence of a vital different from the physical. But if you look at the whole question of psychology, evolutionary psychology, from a scientific point of view, the physical is a different principle from the vital. And evolution, the evolution of life, is the product of something other than physical, material forces. And so it's essential to recognize that in a system like the one that Gebser has presented, as Sri Aurobindo says, there are going to be movements within a particular domain of time and structure. Particular structural domain is going to have strong vital influences operating in it, as well as psychic influences and mental influences, and it maybe it's left to the integral to be able to see clearly how these different levels of energy, consciousness, play out in their various memes. You know, Gebser is dealing with memes primarily. He's looking at art, science, artifacts, symbols, and some of these symbols are memes of a kind of magical structure, and some of them are memes of a mythical structure, but that doesn't identify what the causal forces are that are operating in those structures. And this is one of the problems of structuralism, is that it tends to define structures on the basis of visible patterns, and it doesn't see always the dynamics of the whole process, because somehow you have to reduce that process to those structures in order to understand them. And as soon as you do that, you lose a dimension of more of an energetic dimension. And he tries to recover it. He speaks about intensities. The difference between each of these levels is intensity of consciousness. But it still doesn't penetrate into a level of understanding that Sri Aurobindo seems to think is very important. And so we could see last time this the cosmic hierarchy, Sri Aurobindo's cosmic psychology, can have imposed upon it the Gebserian progressions quite easily. It can have imposed upon it the spiral dynamics progression quite easily. And yet those two in themselves don't contain necessarily that level of understanding that is essential for Sri Aurobindo. So the vital itself seems to be capable of a vast range of mimetic expressions, from the most violent to the most ethical and balanced to the most spiritual. So then maybe we could understand that the psychic can emerge in the vital memes, or it can be a purely vital meme.
Yeah.
You know, which is somehow not only deficient, but very dark in its evolutionary origins. So the whole question may be just a little bit more complex than we're getting it in this form, although the way we're getting it in this form, I think, is quite accurate. Yeah. So I've decided that somehow Gebser has Sri Aurobindo's mind, but he doesn't necessarily have his spiritual knowledge and energy. But as far as the mind goes, it seems to be very, very closely aligned.
I have a question about this blind, isolating ego that you mentioned. And from what you're saying, does it just mean that the vital is pretty well running wild and under the surface ruling us, so that we have big disruptions, increasing suicides, increasing depression? What's happening under this? If the ego is just isolated in its own little box, and the negative side of things is starting to work, is the vital just under there doing
something
unnoticed?
Yes, it opens up, as he says. It makes it, because of this unclarity in the mind, which should sustain, so to say, true relations and see things and isolate man in a true sense, that he could see, could have an insight into his psyche. Instead of that, it is being substituted or used or misused by the psyche in such a way, in a deficient way, bringing the worst out of it into the mind. And because ego is isolated in a sense, it opens up to the deeper unknown nature, the dark nature and forces which are which can enter now in the pretext of assured statement, because there is some feeling of truth in this statement. So I can insist upon it because I have an experience of it. And since I have an experience of it, I may insist on it and introduce all the other forces which are invisible, entering and destroying the whole thing. And that is what is happening nowadays. You can see people going to psychiatrists and psychologists non-stop because, first of all, they have no content in their life. Their life lost content because of this perspectival deficient form of mental rational structure. So, kind of, they have everything, but they have nothing. They are watching movies, TVs, everything is here, car to carry them to the supermarket to buy things, and they don't feel alive. Because there is no content in this life when it is outward. There was the whole survey in Norway, my wife is from Norway, so she's working in that organization where they are inquiring why people are not, when they have everything, very nice job, very nice salary, beautiful house, kids in the kindergarten, everything is taken care of, after 3 weeks being on medication, don't want to come back to work. Why they escape from working? They want to find some other way of living. And that is a deeper problem which mental structure brings in. Our isolated being, which searches for its own self-assertion, finds wrong, deficient powers of magic and deficient psychic structure, and which are entering from darker nature. And we have all kinds of distortions, we can see it in our life. If you observe carefully what is happening in the society nowadays, you will see all those distortions from mental from magic structure, coming as mental now. For example, I'm not saying a sex abuse, I'm saying change of sex. Where it comes from? Why that it becomes an issue and a kind of important part of life? It is coming from magic structure as a new possibility reconfirmed by the mental. You as individual, as ego sense, you can do that. Or other things.
Plastic surgery.
Yeah, plastic surgery, changing your appearance.
But it doesn't change anything.
Doesn't change a thing. It stays the same.
But the thing is that unless you don't have, your mind doesn't support infinite thought, infinite progress, something which doesn't end, something where you can have an expectance of opening up to. It is unknown, you don't know what is coming up. But the thought, the concept as such, is put in such a way that there is this possibility of a larger vision. Then you don't have such problems. But I believe... Please go ahead.
My question would be, don't we have our own understanding yet of what the term ego means? Because maybe there's different stages of development of the ego, or the instrument, or the outer being, whatever you want to call it. And parallel to that, also different levels or different stages of isolation or solidification of what you would call the ego. I can see also a possibility where my intent from the mental part of my being to think of things as infinite and connected helps me to expand and not to be so confined. But it might just as well be an extension of my ego. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I have a larger capacity for identification through my ego with a larger reality as part of me. So I think there's probably very different ways of actually saying, well, what is the ego actually, and how does it function? How does it evolve?
But you're talking about Sri Aurobindo's beyond ego, a little bit, aren't you?
I don't know.
The term beyond ego.
Depends on from which place I'm coming. If I'm just totally identified with this part of me that is mentally eager to grasp reality and so on, there's probably a psychic spark behind that, but it's mainly that eagerness of the ego to conquer intellectual space or other spaces but it might still pretty much be the ego. It's very different from an ego that is perhaps very identified with the primal desires and needs and comforts and all of that. And they might have a different experience of how they feel separate, or the extent to which they feel isolated and therefore distraught or depressed about their egoness. You know, if I'm fully identified with a happy ego, there might be not so much suffering until I reach the point that Vladimir talks about, where I meet the emptiness.
It seems like the question, who am I and what is my purpose? I mean, was that at the very beginning of that mental shift? I don't know what the timeline is, but and here we have the result of it is people in a severe discontent in their life. Because I'm not the house, my purpose wasn't this, and I'm still left with the questions, and the distractions no longer distract me enough. So who am I? Why am I here?
And how is Gebsa going to help you with that? Would be a question. If not, then what are we doing here?
In the integral, it seems to be to answer that question in an inclusive way. You know, that expansion that you were talking about. You know, the can the mind move into the expanse without, in the process of quantifying it, making it something that it's not? That's the question. It's a question.
In the separation of the mind, there are two things happening at the same time. There's definition of the separate being, which is very necessary, as Krebs says later, for the concretion of time. The concretion of manifestation of the spirit and time. So in that sense, we have to have something definite in our hand, something which is maybe not fully real yet. Yes, because it works by separation, but it defines the reality in terms of dealing with that later in a concrete sense. Now this is a transition. The mental structure is a transition. It's a claim of the magic over the mythical, in outer terms. But at the same time, it is necessary, because through that that mask of the magic structure reappears again in a new form as an ego sense and plays another role. It's another magic mask with psyche behind. Now there is another game, so to say. It reorients us from the origin towards the future, from the past-oriented knowledge towards the future-oriented knowledge. And that makes all the trick. The isolation itself is a means to concretize the archaic structure, to make it concrete, to make it conscious of itself in individual terms. Because there are no other terms to become conscious. Only in individual terms you can become conscious.
I think your question regarding the who am I was not such a question for the Greeks when, or for the Hindus, when the mental structure first emerged. Then the question was, what is? And thought and knowledge were an attempt to grasp the nature of being. Then the next period of mental concretization in the Middle Ages seems to have been when the question started to be what, who am I, or what am I? Because then, by that time, by the time of Descartes, the external world had receded in importance, and the focus was on mind itself. So perhaps now we have gotten to the point that we know enough about who we are and what nature is to ask further what is the nature of the self with respect to the totality.
What is this all about?
what is it all? Because we know this part of it, which is I and ego and mind, is a way of looking at it, and looking at it scientifically and naturally is a way of looking at it, and yet the identity isn't established. And so then we begin a process of recovering all the different levels of concretization. So perhaps there was a concretization of matter in the initial philosophies of nature, and then a concretization of the vital in expansion and conquering nature and creating balance in between human society and nature of some kind, and then a concretization of spirit in thought. But what Gebser is leading towards is the concretization of the spiritual. And that means that matter and spirit then become one continuum of who we are. So that the psychological problem for the mental ego is that it isn't able to connect with that who we are. It connects with the who I am. And that's exactly the transition that human beings are facing.
And it's so interesting because in the Vedas there are answers to those questions, but they are not of a scientific origin.
Yes.
So here we are, how do we balance and...
They don't answer the question adequately. There's an answer there, but it doesn't integrate everything, as Vladimir said. Their language was an affirmation of the total, the totality, the luminosity, the presence of being. But that affirmation doesn't give us a direction from here to where we have to go, and all of the things that can be done. So it's a static affirmation. Sri Aurobindo has brought that whole Vedic mythological consciousness into another level, in Savitri especially, completely integrated with the rational. And so the directional time is there, the mental sectorization of all the planes of existence is there, the experience, the psychological experience of all the emotions and depth of experience that are possible are all there, but they're presented in that magical, mythological framework where the word reconnects with all of those things. It doesn't speak about them, it doesn't speak of them, or it doesn't just speak like the mind normally does. It integrates. It's a magical text, but it's not a purely magical text because it integrates everything. So it becomes an integral text. And Gebser realized that Sri Aurobindo had made that step, which he was theorizing about psychologically.
Poetry is necessary.
Do you disagree with what I just said?
I fully agree. I think that is also something, the power of the text which is presented, for example, in Savitri, is from that magic depth of power, which is, you know, common to all of us, which acts in an impersonal way over the soul. And there is also the experience of the soul, the vision, the imagination of the soul, of that primal myth, or that origin, or knowing of the soul, is also there, present in the word. And at the same time, it is very rational. It's not irrational. It's not anti-rational. Everybody with a rational mind can understand that word and can even figure out some relations and some deeper structures which are presented there. So all these structures are presented in that poetry. Of course, not every poetry, but Sri Aurobindo's poetry. Not every poetry is necessary. Maybe...
necessary for that purpose.
Yeah, pops up to my mind when you speak to about poetry. It came to my mind from the German literature, Dr. Faustus of Goethe. And I had the feeling into it that the figure of Dr. Faustus is the man who has to go through rationalism to find eternity, in the way that he says, his main saying is, maybe I say first in German, ich will finden, was die Welt im Innersten zusammenhält. That means I want to know what the world keeps together in the innermost being. And Mephisto might be the figure which represents the magical consciousness, which says, yes, I'm tempting you. I give you something, but at the moment you say, I'm happy now with all what I have, then I will take the soul. Then you're mine. And in that moment, Dr. Faustus releases its soul, that means also the potentiality of a future development. And so for me it comes together that we have to go through this rational development, through the search, through the asking, through this, argumenting and all the things, arguments, to find more of the world. But what saves his soul in the end is not the rational mind, it is something else, it's the love. It's love, and love is the unifying factor of everything in that case. So, but maybe this drama wants to express, we have to go through all these stages to find the unifying factor in the end. And also what Ladislav mentioned, this being able to think in infinity, to point to infinity, to bear that. So for me it's interesting that not only in the Vedas, but in any forms of literature you can might be figure out what is what you're talking about just now. Mm-hmm.
It comes one thing to my mind when I hear all this, and what can we do with this this old king Solomon, the wise? He said, all what we are doing as men, thinking, doing, everything comes from vanity. What can we do with this? I ask, what do you think? How can you put it in?
How can you work with this?
Yeah.
But if we try to work with this, then according to what you just say, it might be also out of vanity.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
It's yeah, but it's hard to get out of it. Developmental psychology means that through the ego,
yeah,
we create eventually harmony, which was pre-existent, but it has to be expressed through opposition. That's the law of the material versus the spiritual. So if it comes out of vanity, that's fine. It ends up being the truth of the self. It seems to be a strange way to go about it sometimes. But here in Oroville, you know, obviously we have some kind of faith, that all of our stupidities are going to lead to something meaningful. So there's an energy in this psychicized, vital, physical, mental complex. Vain or not, it's carrying us towards something that seems worthwhile, because we work at it all the time. vain fools that we are.
Yeah, it kind of speaks to this thing where...
At least we're not conquering the natives. Oh, are we?
Our own natives, inside. But no, I was thinking it speaks to the same thing all the time, that, you know, where do you place this work with the ego? And over the years I've heard so many different approaches to dealing with the ego, but one of the predominant ones has been, we have to get rid of the ego. And so if you start questioning yourself, well, am I doing this from an ego point of view, you probably have to admit, if your ego is a little bit developed, that everything is almost from the ego. So then all you are left with is doing nothing, which might be just another ego trick. So I don't think that is the solution. You have to, as Rod says, we have to develop mentally, just approach and accept our process. And somewhat, by looking back perhaps, we can establish that there might have been some progress in a desirable direction, you know. But I think the ego will be sitting on our shoulder for quite some years to come, mm-hmm. you know.
So there is,
at least mine, I'm
there
sure.
There's still space for hope. Yeah?
It's sitting here right now.
You're about to hit somebody with the microphone over there. I just listened to some lines from Savitri this morning, which said, escape brings not the victory and the crown. Mm. So in this most highly spiritualized integral verse, there is the message that the product of this effort of human being is a kind of transcendence that includes a victory over ignorance and the ego. But we're not allowed to not conquer it. So it's very essential to the progress.
Yeah, hold on to your ego.
If the ego didn't get some enjoyment out of it, then we wouldn't make any progress.
Sri Aurobindo says very simple, the ego was the helper, ego is the harm.
Yep.
And that's the whole thing. It was a helper and it should be a helper. Even later, when there is a discussion of this ego, is there a state where there is no ego? Or is there a state of mukti or liberation where you do have no ego anymore? And he says that in letters, that he even doubts that there is a state of pure, so to say, nirvikalpa samadhi, where ego is not there at all, because since we are still functioning here in the world, it consolidates, it brings things together in a perspectival sense for the action outside and inside and for everything else. So it is needed as a formation. It will be weakened, it will be the efforts. Yes, it will be a helper of some kind, yes? But not a dominant principle, not a leader. Mm-hmm. It will be a servant to do the work. One will remain free from it, but when one demolishes ego fully and becomes blank, then one returns to the origin, and there is no way to come back. And that is something else altogether. It's just destroying the manifestation.
And there's a big ego behind that too.
And he says it's not for sure that is final liberation, because of the intent of the Supreme to come down and to manifest, that ego, that soul, so to say, will be thrown again into the...
this is mythical polarization. That's the perfect example of how we create, for the sake of meaning, mm-hmm. for the sake mm-hmm. of purpose, mm-hmm. a concept of polarization, you know, between what has to come down and what's already there that needs to be changed. So it's important to recognize that in Sri Aurobindo's work, although he uses that polar structure, he moves beyond the polar structure into a very directional endeavor to integrate the poles, so that the polarity is not accepted as such. We could quite happily, in a kind of religious sort of way, accept this polarization. So then the supermind descends into matter, and matter evolves, and someday everything becomes perfect. End of story. That is a typical mythological understanding.
This is actually the typical mental understanding
of mythology, right? But when you see people assuming that is the ultimate statement of the truth, and not engaged in the linear development of what it implies, then you have the religious structure.
We have to add that in an efficient mental sense. Right,
yes.
Right. Then it becomes clear. Yes.
So I think this old king was just in the line. He was not so far.
Today. Solomon?
Solomon.
He was wise man.
But the question to me is still always, when I walk out of this room, like today, what do I take with me?
That the traffic, is being driven by the magical structure.
Yes. But, you know, it's always a question that I have, like, oh, I walk out of here and I'll move into other spaces with other people and with myself. Mm. But what is it that stays with me that... makes a difference for me. And sometimes my mind cannot put words on it, but maybe I can feel it. And sometimes I can put my mind on it and say, yeah, there's something I caught there that gave a new insight that will help me. So I'm curious if anybody at this point has something that particularly stood out today that you say, oh, I got that, or I got that. Or, I got this feeling.
I'm not sure that you need to have a mental idea about what happened, because what you described sounds a lot to me like how I feel after a Vipassana course, where you don't say anything for 10 days, you're just in the magic and mythical structure section. And then at the end of the course, people talk to each other and they can't talk about what they've been experiencing. You start talking about how you're going to arrange a next course. And I think but where at least I feel it, and where I feel it in relation to this exercise here, is in the way that, unbeknown to me, things have rearranged in my consciousness. And I have a different way of being in the world. Like, since I've read Gebser, I feel I'm different in the world. The magical and the mythical are mm-hmm. very real. The archaic is more, its absence or my failure to be in touch with it is more poignant. And I'm not going to be the same.
Hmm. Well, this answers my question. Thank you.
What time is it?
It's almost 12:30. Huh? 1 minute. Actually, it's there. So we could have a last minute of silence and... call it a day.